For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. So is that something by Rachmaninoff?
Yeah, it's a Rachmaninoff prelude on G-sharp minor, opus 32, number 12.
Wonderful. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg, and with me, my esteemed colleague from the music faculty at Carthage, Dr. Wael Farouk, who is the director of keyboard studies here, and the guiding force behind a very exciting event that actually spans the entire week, namely the Lakeside Piano Festival, which involves several different performances, one of which I'm privileged to be part of. And it's a celebration that will showcase not only some of Carthage's most gifted students and some of Carthage's faculty, but also a very special guest artist who comes to play the recital tonight that kicks off the festival. And you have met Jorge Frederic Osorio if you listened to the morning show this past Thursday. So we want to talk about him and his impressive legacy with Dr. Farouk, but also talk about some of the other offerings that will be part of the Lakeside Piano Festival. So Dr. Wael Farouk, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg.
So I'm trying to remember at what point, since coming to Carthage, how long there has been this thing called the Lakeside Piano Festival. When did you create it, and what did you hope to accomplish by creating such an event?
Right, so this is my third year here at Carthage, and this will be the second festival. So during the first year, I tried to do a little bit of investigative work and to put few things in place. So when we would kick off our first festival, which was last year, we wanted to have too much practicing and rehearsing during the festival. So in a way, the vision of having this festival here, not only to attract internationally renowned artists of the caliber of Mr. Osorio or Ms. Dinnerstein, as you heard her recital last year, which was an amazing experience with the Bach and Goldberg variations, but also to invite our community to come and witness these amazing concerts for free and to be a part of the radical hospitality, which Carthage is all about. And at the same time, it's a great learning experience for our students to be exposed to high-level performances and to have master classes and workshops with these great artists, but also to participate and showcase themselves, as you kindly mentioned earlier, was the Keyboard Student Showcase, which will be this Friday. And lastly, to in effort to set a good example and good model to show the keyboard faculty in the closing recital and how collegial the atmosphere and how much collaboration and how much of taking a village to raise a community. Mm-hmm. And plus, it's a great privilege to play this amazing instrument with its wide literature. And this year, the theme is collaboration, and we'll have a solo recital with Mr. Isario, and then our concert on Saturday night with Schubert's masterpiece Winterreise, and the closing recital on Sunday will be all collaborations, duets, trios, chamber concerto, etc., etc.
Wonderful. About Mr. Osorio, I want to ask you about him specifically in a moment, but ahead of that, I want to ask a more general question about sort of the world of renowned pianists, and how it is that you come to know each other. For instance, Ms. Dienerstein, who performed here last year, and Mr. Osorio, who is going to be playing tonight. Generally speaking, how do these connections get made between pianists?
Right. In the specific channel of between pianists, as you know, the music world is relatively small, and it kind of could go in many, many ways. In terms of connections, right? It's a small world. We all get to know each other by reputation, by name, by, for instance, with Simona Dienerstein, we were actually classmates, even though a couple decades apart, but we had the same teacher in New York, Solomon Makowski, who was one of the greatest pedagogues worldwide. And we met actually first time in Manhattan when the Manhattan School of Music was honoring us by putting our portraits up as some of their distinguished graduates. And I got the privilege of meeting Simona, and then we went to Cuba. We participated in a couple festivals together, and then we became, close acquaintance. And then, of course, I thought it will be a tremendous experience and will bring a great publicity to our program if someone of that caliber would come and do our first, open our first festival last year. As with Jorge, he is also my colleague at Roosevelt University, where we both teach there. And very interestingly, he is one of the most wonderful and humble human beings I got to meet. And of course, as you know from his biography, a very, very accomplished artist.
So tell our listeners a little bit about the repertoire that Mr. Osorio is going to be playing tonight. I mean, he spelled it out for us in our interview last Thursday, but I would be really curious to hear what you have to say about sort of the span of repertoire that will be represented and what will be distinctive about these works that he's going to be playing.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's selecting a German classics repertoire, Haydn, Schubert, and Beethoven. Of course, the Beethoven sonata that he is closing his program with is Opus 111, which is Beethoven's final piano sonata, number 32. And in many, many ways, this work is a peak. It's really, if Beethoven chose to have this work to be the bookend for those enormous sonatas, all 32 of them, with only two movements, he felt that he doesn't need to have a three-movement sonata or even four movements or five movements two were more than enough. The second movement is an arietta and variations, and it's, to say the least, it's just sublime. The great Russian pianist Anton Rubinstein, who was one of the founders of the Russian school of piano playing, said, the human race does not deserve this work. Just to give you a hint of how really immortal this piece is, and it speaks not just profoundly of what the piano can do, but of it's a height of human emotion and expressivity, and of course an incredible creativity of Beethoven, as he does in every single work. The Schubert sonata that Mr. Isari will be playing, D959, is one of the three last works for piano that he wrote, the last three great piano sonatas, C minor, A major, and B flat major. And they are heavenly in length, as Schumann used to call most of Schubert's works. It spans about 45 minutes or so. The slow movement in particular is quite astounding, and it echoes a lot of Beethoven's struggles and search for peace. As you know, they died just 1 year apart, and Schubert used to follow Beethoven as much as he can on his daily walks. Benjamin Britten called the last 14 months of Schubert's life perhaps the greatest 14 months of music history.
Just in terms of what he created.
Absolutely. One masterpiece after the other, and of course, yeah. One of the other great masterpieces of that period is Winterreise, which we'll have the pleasure of playing with you on Saturday. So,
and then finally on this recital tonight, or is it just the...
So he will start by a smaller sonata by Haydn, as an, I don't want to say appetizer, of course, but as a nice opening for the recital before these two giant works, and then the Schubert, and then he will close with the Beethoven, which happens to be at the same key as the Haydn as well, both in C minor.
Very good.
But Haydn, of course, Beethoven studied with Haydn for a small period of time, if we can ever say that Beethoven had a teacher. So in many ways, there is a length and there is a homage between both works.
I think one thing that our listeners might find interesting is to have you talk for a moment about what instrument these composers composed for. That is, Haydn and Beethoven and Schubert. Because... I mean, they're called piano sonatas, and the instruments for which they composed them were, in some ways, pianos, but not exactly the pianos that we have now.
Right.
Explain the difference between the pianos of that day, what they were called, and how they differ from a modern piano, and to what extent you think that has anything to do with what they composed or how they composed these pieces. How were they affected by that instrument of their day and its potential as well as its limitations?
Sure. That's a great question, complex, and I will try to do it justice. Beethoven and Schubert, as well as Haydn, of course, resided in Austria for... I mean, Schubert, all of his life. Beethoven moved there from Germany earlier on in his career. However, there are always two schools of thoughts. Do I write for the instrument I have, or I am very much limited by the means of today and I foresee the future? It has to do a little bit with the personality of the composer. It has to do with what they are trying to say. Composers, in many ways, one way or another, really, they are especially of that caliber, they're always pushing limits, regardless if it's the, you know, the human voice, or if it's the orchestration or the numbers of musicians in orchestra or the highest registers, you know, that they could reach, or with the limitation of an instrument like the piano. Also, Beethoven's very, very last works, the string quartets, he was still pushing the limits of these instruments. And many, many musicians of that time who were really on top of the game, they claimed that these amazing writings for the string quartet, even though they are absolutely a miracle of music substance, but they're unplayable on the instruments. If we look at somebody like Schubert, he used the Viennese piano or the pianoforte, really, which was very, very different than today's piano, even very different than the piano that Beethoven preferred, which is a Broadwood. Beethoven came from a line very close to Clementi's mindset, which preferring the English piano, giving him greater sonorities, wider range, larger numbers of keys, more possibilities with pedaling. Beethoven really was the first great imaginary of overtones and pedaling possibilities, and some of his sonatas are astonishing, and one could really wonder if, you know, if he is mad or if he cannot hear, pun intended. But of course, none of this is true. He's, you know, way ahead of his time. I believe he's still way ahead of our time today. Schubert was content with the instrument he had. He didn't even own a piano for the longest of periods. He was too poor to have one, and those last remarkable works he wrote as just they were flowing out of him. He was giving dictations to his friends who were staying around him. He was very feverish at the end of his life. He died of syphilis, as you know. He was very sick, hallucinating often, and you can see glimpses of those hallucinations in the slow movement of the A major sonata. But he, in many ways, like Mozart, he was content with the instrument he had. It didn't limit his creativity, but he was still writing amazing music. Beethoven, as we know, always was nagging piano manufacturers, asking them for more resonance, for larger sonorities on the keys. He was known to be a very tempestuous performer, breaking often keys, breaking hammers and performance, breaking strings, etc., etc. There are many accounts of his friends and colleagues turning pages for him of some performances and saying afterwards in their diary how much harder they worked than Beethoven, because they were trying to, you know, put the hammers back in place and making the piano, the music rack, you know, bring it up again, because everything shook while he's playing, and he is very, very passionate, apparently composer and performer as well.
I had the opportunity to play some Schubert on a forte piano that would have been roughly comparable to the instrument that for which he composed, and I remember feeling like it was such a small instrument compared to what we're used to, and of course trying to get the sound from it that that one wants to have, and also this sense I was Earl Koenig was one of the things I played, but I remember feeling like the whole instrument was just going to shake apart. It's just intriguing to think of what they would have made of the modern piano that we're used to hearing now.
Correct. And even during Chopin's time, you know, he pianos were a lot different then than today, and in many ways you had over 150 manufacturers of pianos, and, you know, just by the 1880s, 1870s, 1890s, and the turn of the century, of course. And even somebody like the great Franz Liszt was saying, I have one of his students, Arthur Friedheim, asked him if it's okay to edit a little bit some of his writing, some of his Hungarian Rhapsodies, maybe not to have as many octaves or something of that sort. And Liszt said, of course, the main reason of me doubling octaves all the time in those early days, especially that those Erard pianos were very light at the bass. And, but he said, one day there will be a better instrument, and with a good musician, they would know how, what to do, and they know, they would know how to consult their ears, and you know, let it be that. So even somebody like that, who played on every single instrument available under the sun, still knew that there will be a, you know, a more perfect instrument, and thankfully, we are, you know, experiencing it today in our time.
So, Mr. Osorio tonight will be playing the beautiful Steinway Concert Grand that adorns Siebert Chapel, and that that recital is at 7:30.
Correct.
And it is actually, I think, technically speaking, a ticketed event, so it is preferred that people secure a ticket for it.
Correct. Even though all the events of the festival are free, but in order to keep better track of attendance and to secure that there will be enough seats for everybody, that's the way the school is going.
Very good. So we encourage people to go to carthage.edu to seek out information. Go to the bridge, and you will find a link very easily to tonight's recital and find out more about that. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Wael Farouk, who is head of keyboard studies at Carthage and overseeing the Lakeside Piano Festival, which kicks off tonight with this guest recital by Jorge Frederic Osorio, who is on the piano faculty at Roosevelt University and a renowned concert pianist playing music of Haydn, Schubert, and Beethoven. And he will also be doing a master class midday tomorrow, Wednesday.
Correct. 10 to 12, we'll have four of our amazing students playing for him.
And people are welcome to come and be in the audience of that.
Absolutely.
Very good. So. I know that Friday there is a showcase of some of Carthage's most talented students, and you mentioned it will be organ and piano featured.
Correct.
In Friday night's keyboard showcase of some of our best students. Most gifted students. And then Saturday, you and I get to perform together Schubert's masterwork, is or one of them, but one of the really towering masterworks, his final song cycle, Winterreise. From the pianist's point of view, what kind of an opportunity does Winterreise offer to you?
To me personally?
Right. I mean, as the pianist, I mean, right. As a pianist, what, or for any pianist who gets to play Winterreise, what kind of challenges and opportunities does it present?
Right. I would have to say, even though it's a wonderfully complex work, I would have to say I am often at ease at that side of Schubert. We have, especially when we have a tremendous artist like yourself guiding the vocal line, it is very easy to know where things are going. He is an amazing songwriter. He is an amazing, he is really a master of melodies. Few composers have that great talent, really. Mozart is definitely one of them. If I'm playing something solo by Schubert, perhaps it's one of the hardest tasks that you can ask of a pianist, because the rubato of Schubert's, the diction, if I may use that word, even when you're playing solo, everything, every note he pens really is vocal, is human. But I don't want to say like I hide behind a singer, especially when they know what they are doing. But it's a tremendous, tremendous experience, both rewarding musically and tremendous learning experience as well. I recall reading the first encounter with Vladimir Horvitz and Gary Graffman, when Gary Graffman wanted to go and play for Horvitz and study with him for the following 3 years or so. And Horvitz gave Gary Graffman a large amount of voice recordings, of vocal recordings. He didn't give him, you know, his own piano recordings. He didn't give him the, you know, Rachmaninoff or the Schnabel or the, you know, Hoffman piano recordings, but he gave him a sizable collection of voice recordings, vocal recordings, and he asked him to listen and to learn from those. We are all frustrated singers, he says that. So.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So Saturday evening, Winterreise, the winter's journey of Franz Schubert, that Dr. Farouk and I will be performing together. And then finally, the festival finishes out with what you are titling rather flamboyantly, I should say, an extravaganza. And actually, I think the word is very fitting in terms of what is planned. So explain to our listeners the wonderful array of works that will be part of Sunday afternoon's extravaganza.
Right. So last year's extravaganza theme, since we are in the midst of the Brahms project, if you recall, we had all works of Brahms on that concert, including all but one of the organ works, which my colleague, Mr. Berry, masterfully played. This year, since we are not honoring a particular composer, so my colleague's creativity and highest level of artistry will be really exhibited. We will open the concert with my good colleague Debbie Maslowski and the guest artist Martin Davids playing Handel D major violin sonata for harpsichord and violin. And then my wonderful colleague Fumi Nakayama, she will play Brandenburg Concerto No. 5 for harpsichord, flute, violin, and chamber orchestra. And Fumi, as you will know, is a master of many trades like yourself, and I'm looking forward to hearing this particularly myself because I didn't have the pleasure of hearing her play the harpsichord before. And of course Hideko Amano, our wonderful flute faculty, she will be one of the soloists. Mary Kelly Hutchinson will be the violin soloist, and a really beautiful bouquet of students from the Carthage Philharmonic. And this is something else we intentionally try to incorporate in every festival and or in every large concert series, is to have our future colleagues perform with us. If you remember the last Brahms concert with Ilya Kahler last year, we had Mary Kelly and Schützi open the performance with Brahms's amazing work, Sonatensatz, one movement for piano and violin. So we'll be continuing that theme this year, and then after intermission with my good colleague Alison Hall, we'll do Schumann's wonderful song cycle, Liederkreis, and then to close the concert, Debbie and Fumi will play together Ravel La Valse, arranged for two pianos.
Fantastic. So all of these events outlined on Carthage's website go to the bridge, and there's a calendar of events that give information on everything that is going on with this year's Lakeside Piano Festival, including tonight's guest recital by Jorge Frederic Osorio, playing music of Haydn, Schubert, and Beethoven. Dr. Wael Farouk, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you and all of your colleagues for a very, very successful Lakeside Piano Festival.
Thanks so much, Greg.
And the time is 8:39. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and for part two of today's program, I'm happy to be sitting across the table from another faculty colleague from Carthage, Herschel Kruger, who is from the theater faculty at Carthage College and the director of their current production, which opened this past weekend, namely Marie Antoinette by David Ajmi. And of course, there is not too many figures out of history whose name evokes such a strong response as Marie Antoinette, and yet it's somebody we don't necessarily fully understand and fully appreciate. Along with Professor Kruger, we have two young women who are very closely associated with this production. Samantha Salmi is the assistant director of Marie Antoinette. She is a junior at Carthage, a theater major with a directing emphasis. And also with us is Marie Antoinette herself, Lydia Hassel, who is also a junior at Carthage. She is a theater performance and music theater double major, and she is portraying the title role in this play. So we welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thanks for having us, Greg.
Good to have you here. And Professor Kruger, you were saying that this past weekend, which was when the show opened, was a tremendous success.
Yeah, it went very well, and the audience laughed when they were supposed to, and they were quiet and very attentive when they needed to be, without any coughing. That's always a really good sign.
So how would you characterize this work? I mean, is it actually a comedy slash drama?
It's really mixed, because it is a comedy and drama, but it's also very absurd. It's episodic, very Brechtian, and satirical. So you have these different forms kind of mashed together, and it gives you license to be able to do a lot of things, but they still have to dovetail together, so there's continuity and a hole in the storytelling. So that's the challenge of it. So you can't go too far, but when those elements present themselves, I think you need to take advantage of it.
So obviously a play titled Marie Antoinette is about Marie Antoinette in some respect. I mean, what is David Ajmi doing with this charismatic figure out of history?
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It very closely follows her life and a couple of biographies that I've read. But it really starts with just after her and Louis are anointed as king and queen, up until her beheading, which we all know what happens to her. And that's a lot of storytelling. So different events sometimes are joined together, and they move forward quickly. I mean, there could be a play just about the necklace episode, which is one of the important events in her life, where the tide started to turn against her. You know, there could be something about the Bastille. And, I mean, there's so much material that they have to move through it efficiently, but tell the story and show Marie going through these different changes and seeing the frivolous young woman she starts as, and even though it's too late, the woman who she becomes. So I'm not just going to say, you know, she was a victim, because some of it she brought on herself, but, you know, she was born to be a princess, to be a queen, and she really didn't do a lot to develop herself as a leader until later in life, when it was too late. And I think that's a really important part of the play, is it asks us about who our leaders are and what we expect from them. And I think that's pretty timely right now.
Speaking of leaders, your assistant director is sitting right next to you.
Yes, she is.
Just say a quick word about the role that student directors play in a production like Marie Antoinette. How do you tend to utilize their talents and skills?
Well, Sammy wasn't just a sounding board or someone who got me coffee or water, even though I don't drink coffee, but she would get me water sometimes. But she directed a couple of scenes in the play. She handled all the tech and the utilization of the sound and lighting and music that are part of the play. So she worked, you know, side by side with me. And sometimes I, you know, would go to her and say, how do you think this looks, or how's it working? Or what was really great is this play is very specific in its language. And it's at the beginning of the play, Ajmi writes, like, for the setting, he says there's a guillotine, there's Versailles, there's Trianon, there's the palace, the Tuileries, and a couple other things. So it's very sparse, doesn't give any descriptions of anything. And it's not meant to be realistic, but then he spends a page and a half about his own punctuation that has stops and double slashes and question marks and things in parentheses and on, and how he wants this language to work. Beats, pauses, long silences. So a couple of times I'd be like, Sammy, just watch the language and the punctuation today, because there's a rhythm that he's looking for, and he wants to break our naturalistic tendencies. And I think he says the language is more of a rubato, right? Mm-hmm. So
nice music term. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is very musical. And so there'd be a variety of things that she did.
Hmm. Sounds like a wonderful assignment for you. What has been most challenging for you as assistant director, or maybe most satisfying in terms of the responsibilities you've had?
Definitely. I think the most satisfying thing would be being able to work with the resources that the main stage does allow. A lot of the directing that I've done at Carthage has been in our studio theater, which, although is a directing experience, the resources are limited in the lights and the sound. So being able to play with things like creating fireworks and picking the colors and picking the sounds that they make and when they go off, being able to have those bigger opportunities in that sense was a lot of fun and really important to my education to work with. So
wonderful. Yeah, that sounds quite exciting. Well, let's talk about this intriguing figure of Marie Antoinette. Lydia Hassel, you have the opportunity of portraying her in David Ajmi's play. Ahead of becoming part of this cast, what, if anything, did you even know about Marie Antoinette?
Honestly, I didn't know too much about her. Obviously, I knew she didn't actually say let them eat cake, but people like to think that she did. And I knew that she was beheaded and that she was a big figure in France. So I ended up doing a lot of research before I got to rehearsals. I went through my script, looked up all the terms, all the people that were listed, and I watched some documentaries, read some articles and books about her, just to really embody the historical figure.
Hmm. I suppose that is an intriguing challenge for any young actor, is when we're talking about someone who is actually a figure from history. And in a sense, you don't quite have the same poetic license that one does when the figure is fiction.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely there's more to draw on, so you have to be careful that your representation is consistent or aligned with the figure as we know them. But I think it's kind of fun as an actor to do a profile, and you could ask yourself just a whole list of questions, starting with how similar am I or how different am I from Marie? What are my viewpoints on religion? What are my viewpoints on leadership and on the monarchy versus democratic rule? I mean, that's a big part of her life in the French Revolution, and it could be even simple things about I dress myself every day. This is what it's like to have servants. Marie was always being watched and dressed and cared for, and even when she gave birth, there was hundreds of people who came to watch her give birth. I mean, she never had a private moment for years. And that's why she created Trianon, so she could get away. That was her little escape, which was less than a mile from Versailles, but it was her escape. And it was also part of her losing an important group of allies, because the courtiers felt she abandoned them as she would escape for days at a time, years on end, to Trianon. And so when the revolution started gaining more and more power, a lot of people abandoned her and weren't there for her because they felt she had abandoned them.
Wow. So Lydia, what occurs to the character through the course of this play? In what way does she evolve and change? And in what way is that something that you have to portray?
Yeah, so we see her get to Versailles when she's 14 years old, and she's forced into an arranged marriage with Louis. And we see that she doesn't, I mean, she doesn't really understand the views of the poor people. She doesn't, she just wants all of these frivolous things. She loves her clothes, her dances, her gambling, and she just cares about her own pleasure. But then she finds out through the course of the revolution that she can't focus on these things because the people are angry at her. They want food. They want to sustain themselves. And it's not until that she is imprisoned that she really starts to understand it. She actually was pretty much illiterate up until the very end, where she ended up reading like the philosophies of Rousseau and Voltaire. And she finally understood, I think it's sad that it was at the end, that monarchy may be not the right way to go, that equality might be what is right for all people.
So her consciousness of that was raised, but way too late
for her to
be saved. Do you think very much, did you think very much in the course of preparing this about making her a sympathetic figure? Because, of course, she's someone who was, at least in her day, viewed very unsympathetically by many, many people. Did you think very much about how she should be viewed, what our feelings for her should be through the course of the play?
Yes, absolutely. As an actor, you really have to find ways to fight for your character. You have to care about your character, even if they might be the villain in this case. But something that we focused on is even early on in the play, when she is frivolous and cares about trivial things, making sure that she seems charming, because people did really like her. She was well-spoken. She was fun to be around. She was a great mother. So it was important to get the audience to really care about her, because in the end, you see her downfall. And it's actually really traumatic and sad to see someone just being ignorant and not seeing these things. And I mean, it ended up leading to her death.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking about Carthage's production of David Ajmi's play, Marie Antoinette. Lydia Hassel portrays Marie Antoinette. Samantha Salmi is the assistant director of the production. And Professor Herschel Kruger is with us as well. He is the director of Marie Antoinette, and there are performances yet to come this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Samantha Salmi, describe to us visually what this production looks like.
Oh, gosh, this production is beautiful. We have the biggest, most extreme costumes you could think of in every vibrant color imaginable. Our costume designer, Veronica Vickis, did such a good job at embodying all of these characters. She did this amazing thing where the royal family, being Louis and Marie, got to wear vibrant, beautiful pastels and golds and really showcase their characters, as the ensemble stayed in grayscale, but they still had the shape of their costumes and body who they were. So we got to see this divide amongst the common people to the royal family. So that really helped play up their characters. We had a beautiful set which evolved from Versailles to her jail just by taking off these shrub panels, turning a beautiful garden wall into boxy jail cell looking aesthetic. We had battens on the sides of our stage, which are big poles with boxes on them. And each box had things like the French flag, macaroons, a chandelier, and broken china to really embody the world of the play without us having to have a whole set to show us where we were. And on the back of each of those boxes, we'd have a title which introduced where we were in the scene. Which helped move the play along, which then turned into an aesthetic thing, because as Marie's life would get messier, we'd leave the boxes astrew on the stage. So we'd go from a beautiful, clean parallel to just a misconstrued mess of a jail. So the writing and the acting, as well as the aesthetics of our set and our costumes, played a huge part in showing us this life and downfall of Marie Antoinette.
Wow, that sounds remarkable. Mm-hmm. That's quite exciting. Professor Krueger, you mentioned at least once the word absurd.
Mm-hmm.
Can you quickly just tell us the element of absurdity that is in David Ajmi's play?
Sure. So I think the first moment in the script, because we created a couple others, but the first moment in the script, Marie is having a scene with her brother Joseph, who is the Emperor of Austria. He's come to Versailles to check up on her. And one of those title boxes comes off, and they turn it around, and it says, a sheep enters the room. And sure enough, a sheep walks in to the room and stops, looks at Marie. Marie looks at the sheep. The sheep walks away, and Marie's transfixed on it. And Joseph is like, Marie, I'm talking to you. She's, you didn't just see a sheep enter the room? Huh. I think it warranted a footnote in our conversation. And the scene moves on, but she's like, and I think the audience is also like, what was that sheep in? And it's a really fantastic costume. So it's a sheep, but it's not a sheep. It's a little Bo Peep, and it's really a lot of fun. But the sheep comes back a few other times, and we realize that it's maybe Marie's subconscious. Marie's a figment of her imagination. It's she's starting to check herself, to look inward. That's something the playwright gives you. So we had to figure it out. He never tells us who the sheep is or why the sheep is there. So, you know, that's been our choice. And the sheep then has a very pivotal scene. There's a couple other scenes, but in 2-6, before she goes to the guillotine, there's a series of scenes in the final months of her life. And that's become one of my favorite parts of the play, and something that I think we really were challenged with at the beginning of the process, and then we kept working, and then it just clicked for us. So that absurd element, as we defined it and brought clarity to it, became a very important part of the play. And there's a few others. So,
Yeah. Sounds intriguing. Although this is not theater of the absurd.
No, it's absolutely not.
Elements of the absurd mm-hmm. that are woven into this yes. narrative. Lydia Hassel, have you ever had a role that even approaches this role, like Marie Antoinette?
I have not. This role is unique in that I had to really build up my endurance because I never leave the stage. Hmm. I'm on stage for the whole almost 2 hours, and even my costume changes occur on stage.
Wow.
So we had to actually incorporate the costume changes into the scene where I would still be changing while we start the dialogue. So just and being in a corset for that long and heels and a 3 foot tall wig, it's something that I had to get used to throughout the process.
Wow. Let alone the emotional journey that that she goes on. And of course, at the end, Marie Antoinette anticipates her own death. And I should think that is a wrenching and rich opportunity for you.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow. And Samantha Salmi, it sounds like this has been the ideal vehicle for someone who aspires to be a director, to have a show with so many interesting and varied challenges.
It definitely was. I got to learn so much about theater as a whole, but especially this style of theater. A lot of things I've directed in the past have just been straight realism, which, although not easy, it does not present as many opportunities for growth or challenges to overcome. So being able to work through things with Herschel and trying different things and being able to lay my opinion out there and having it work or having that opinion spark another opinion has been really incredible in me learning how to collaborate with other directors and other people in the areas of theater. So
how exciting. That's just great. So there is yet another weekend of performances of Marie yes. Antoinette. Tell our listeners when and what they
well,
should
we have performances Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evening at 7:30 p.m. And there are tickets available. You can go to www.carthage.edu/tickets/theater and then follow your screen prompts, or you could call our box office at 262-551-6661. 551-6661.
Very good. Professor Herschel Krueger, the director of Marie Antoinette, Samantha Salmi, his very able assistant director, and Lydia Hassel undertaking the title role of Marie Antoinette on the stage of Carthage College. Thanks to all of you for being part of the morning show today. It's great to talk to you, and this is certainly an exciting thing to look forward to. So best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you here. Tomorrow on the morning show, from the archives, two interviews with Kurt Chalgren, a towering figure in music here in Kenosha. Kurt Chalgren died several days ago, and we will go back to the archives and relive a couple of memorable conversations with him. And on Thursday, also a memorial of sorts, former baseball major leaguer Ransom Jackson, who passed away last week. We will replay the interview that I recorded with him upon the publication of his memoirs.